The Middle East on edge as fears continue of a widening regional conflict as the U.S. and U.K. launch retaliatory strikes at Iranian-backed Houthi rebels.
These strikes are meant to de-escalate the situation. The actual escalation is done by the Houthi attacks on the vessels. The actual commercial trade has more or less stopped in the region.
Israel defends itself at the UN's top court against allegations of genocide against the Palestinians.
For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare.
And extreme weather conditions in the state of Iowa will challenge voter motivation Monday in what is seen as the start of the 2024 presidential campaign. Hello, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. After months of Houthi attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, the United States, Britain, and other allies, including the Netherlands, responded with a series of powerful airstrikes designed to severely degrade the Iranian-backed group's capabilities.
We participate in this coalition because we feel very strongly about the freedom of navigation. We're very worried about the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea. We've seen an escalation since mid-November. The international community has warned the Houthis to stop these attacks.
The attacks have severely disrupted international commerce on the key route that accounts for about 15% of the world's shipping traffic.
What's happened because of these Houthi attacks against commercial shipping is that thousands of ships have had to divert, take longer routes, pay more for insurance, and that gets translated into higher prices for people for everything from fuel to medicine to food.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up more than a week in the Middle East of meetings with Arab and Israeli leaders, which included efforts to avert a widening regional conflict stemming from Israel's war in Gaza and discussions about what comes next.
If you bring Israel in, if you make the necessary commitments to security, and you move down the path to a Palestinian state, that's the single best way to isolate, to marginalize Iran and the proxies that are making so much trouble for us and for pretty much everyone else in the region.
For perspective, I spoke with Aaron David Miller, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Why do you think that they decided now to do this response, and will it actually tamp things down or lead to further escalation?
I think they looked at this over the last couple months and tried to do everything possible to avoid this. The Saudis didn't want this. They're trying to extricate themselves from Yemen. It's clear that whether or not there's going to be a political settlement in Yemen is a long way away, but the kind of stability that the UN envoy and others have helped to fashion has created a much better, when it comes to Yemen, everything is relative, but a better situation. I think they're worried about that. I think they were also worried about identifying a set of targets that could actually make a difference in degrading Houthi's capacity to attack shipping with short-range ballistic missiles and drones and UAVs. And I think they needed the time to create a multinational, multilateral effort, first with Operation Prosperity Guardian, second with the UN Security Council resolution, and now third with the seven or eight countries that are both warned the Houthis, more actually, but who are now actively associated with their counterstrikes. Australia, Denmark, Netherlands, Canada, Germany, Bahrain, although that's a little sketchy given the Bahraini sensitivity to their own public opinion and demonstrations in the streets over the last 48 hours. So they wanted time to prepare that. And I think the barrage over the last 2 days basically reflected the fact that the Houthis weren't getting the message, and that if you believe in freedom of navigation, then you have to do something about it. I think they're well aware of the constraints in terms of this operation. The Houthis are inured to decades of war. They may actually want this. Their prime backers, the Iranians, are careful that it doesn't escalate beyond a certain level that could threaten Iranian interests. And it's interesting that Houthis are not attacking oil tankers. All of those factors combined, I think, to basically compel the administration to act. And we'll see whether this becomes a strike counterstrike or whether it's going to escalate or continue.
Do you think that we are, even though we're not calling it a war, we're already in some sort of, this could lead to drawing the U.S. into some sort of proxy war with Iran?
No, I don't think we're there yet. I mean, a regional war, let's be clear, define a regional war. We're not talking about what is now playing out. We're talking first and foremost about a major escalation along the Israeli-Lebanese border, where Hezbollah uses its repository of 150,000 to 200,000 high trajectory weapons of varying ranges and lethalities. The Israelis either preempt or respond with a massive ground, sea, and air campaign against Lebanese infrastructure and the southern suburbs where the Hezbollah command and control is. We're talking at the same time pro-Iranian militias in Iraq and Syria attacking U.S. forces. We're talking about an escalation in the Red Sea simultaneously by the Houthis, and with at least one carrier strike group. We're talking about an American response initially against pro-Iranian militias and maybe Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps units. That conflict, which would kill thousands of Lebanese and probably hundreds of Israelis, the Israeli-Lebanese dimension of it, could easily lead to U.S. strikes, again, against Iranian assets, or even to U.S. and or Israeli strikes against Iran and Iran's retaliation against American assets in the Gulf. That's a regional war. That's something the Middle East had never experienced, well beyond the Arab-Israeli issue. That's what everyone is hoping to avoid. I don't think we're anywhere near that. What you have is a controlled conflict between Israel and Hezbollah on the Israeli-Lebanese border. You have, that's one dimension, which is daily. You've got 100 strikes by pro-Iranian Iraqi militias against Americans on Iraqi bases or against American forces in Syria. That occurs irregularly, but it occurs. And you have the Red Sea front. That's not a regional war. That's not what I'm describing. And I think there's still a way to avoid that. We'll see how the Houthis respond. Not sure that piece of this, we're not talking about ground campaign, ground forces. I'm not sure that campaign, that could get hotter, but I don't see it spreading unless the Iranians choose to get involved, or you see a Houthi terror attack against an American asset somewhere in the region.
Well, the other thing that Secretary Blinken really impressed upon was what comes next. What happens the day after this is over? Israel's war on Hamas is over. Stating basically that the only way to ensure peace and security is a two-state solution. He said he secured some commitments from multiple Arab countries to assist with rebuilding and governing, but only if there's a pathway to that Palestinian state and only when the hostilities end. But Israeli leaders have rejected the idea of a two-state solution. They're adamant in their opposition to that. So how does that possibly come to fruition?
Well, first of all, 2024 is not going to be the year of Palestinian state. It's going to be the year of Gaza. And there are no day after or day after the day after scenarios right now that are, in my judgment, magical thinking. At best, and whether you can get a commitment by this Israeli government to some political horizon down the road is unclear, but you're certainly not going to get a commitment in a serious way with this Israeli government, because the government would probably collapse, which is not what Mr. Netanyahu wants. But this is clearly a two-stage process. 2024 is going to be the year of Gaza. Israelis will be operating there for months to come at some level. Hamas may actually survive in some fashion and create a residual insurgency. Maybe the Israelis will tone down their ground campaign and their military activities so you can actually create a relatively stable environment to surge humanitarian assistance and begin the painful process of reconstruction. The Americans will train 6,000 to 8,000 Palestinian security forces at some point. They may be deployed, but not for another 8 to 10 months. So 2024 is the year of Gaza. Should Biden get a second term, that will coincide with leadership changes, I would think, on the Israeli side. What happens on the Palestinian side is anybody's guess, given how chaotic things are. Abbas is in 88 in the 19th year of a four-year term. There's little sense that the Palestinian Authority is going to be reformed. I mean, if he would agree to appoint a prime minister as a technocrat. But Abbas has no credibility. The Palestinian Authority, no Arab state, is going to agree to deploy its forces to maintain security in Gaza. The Egyptians would probably be willing to deal with the border, but that's because it's in their national interest. And no one is talking about a multinational, multilateral force, UN-sanctioned or not UN. Thing. The problem problem is the Arab states have made it unmistakably clear to the secretary and probably to the president that they're not going to contribute the political and financial economic support to phase one unless they see where this is going. Gaza first cannot become Gaza only. And therein lies a huge problem. So I think that's going to produce a huge constraint for this coming year. I think you need to really think about what's happening and divide it at least into these two phases. What can happen between now and November, and what could happen if Biden is reelected?
Aaron David Miller, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. On Thursday, South Africa formally accused Israel of committing genocide against Palestinians. Its lawyers and hearings before the International Court of Justice asked the court to order an immediate halt to Israeli military operations in Gaza.
Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease as a result of the ongoing siege by Israel.
Israel, which vehemently denies the allegations, Friday presented chilling video and audio that focused on the brutality of the October 7th attacks. Israeli legal advisor Tal Becker argued that South Africa was painting a profoundly distorted picture.
South Africa purports to come to this court in the lofty position of a guardian of the interest of humanity. But in delegitimizing Israel's 75-year existence in its opening presentation yesterday, that broad commitment to humanity rang hollow.
The case strikes at the heart of both Israel's and South Africa's national identities. For a deeper look at what is one of the most significant cases heard in an international court and that goes to the core of one of the world's most intractable conflicts, I spoke with historian Omer Bartov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University.
They are speaking in large part in the 84-page filing of Israel carrying out various crimes, including genocidal acts. But at the same time, they're also asking for provisional measures to be taken by the court. And the logic of this is that the court could take years to decide whether a genocide is taking place or not, by which time it may well be over. All kinds of things could happen by then. But because of urgency of the situation, South Africa is asking for provisional measures to be taken by the court within the near future, and for that, it is arguing that it's enough to prove that there's plausibility of genocide, that such measures could also prevent genocide, and that there is what they call irreparable prejudice, that is, that if no measures are taken, there will be more and more acts that could be retrospectively seen as genocidal. And the reason that they have to speak of genocide in the first place is that rather South Africa would have no standing in this court without that. This court would not be dealing with war crimes, but only with the case of genocide, which gives South Africa the ability to accuse another signatory state of that crime. That's written within the Genocide Convention in Section 9.
How strong is South Africa's genocide case against Israel?
The filing itself is extremely detailed, and the presentation was very powerful. There are some questions that need to be dealt with. Some were raised that are technical, whether there's actually a dispute between the two countries, and the court will have to decide on that because that needs to happen to kickstart the whole process. The more important one is whether you can prove intent. And clearly there have been, and in the filing, there's a long laundry list of statements being made by politicians and generals up and down the chain of command that appear to have genocidal intent. And so the question is whether those statements, also ones that directing policy, or they're just rhetoric or made by irrelevant people or people with no executive authority. The people who made these statements, some of them have clearly executive authority. They include the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defense and senior generals and so forth. But are they actually indications of a particular policy, or are they just rhetorical? That's something that the court will have to debate. I think it's hard to prove, but I think there is plausibility plausibility here, which would be sufficient for the court to issue provisional measures.
Such as what South Africa is demanding, an emergency suspension of Israel's offensive. But my understanding is there's no real way to enforce that.
I'm not sure that the court will issue this kind of provisional measure, because that would be seen as extreme. It may require that Israel make more efforts at humanitarian aid. It may require that the IDF be more circumspect in its attacks in heavily populated areas. But yes, eventually, of course, the court cannot enforce this. And in order to enforce this, this would have to go to the Security Council, because the court is part of the UN structure. And the Security Council, since the United States is a member with veto power, would likely veto this.
Israel's arguing that it acted in self-defense, that it gave warnings, that it's targeting Hamas members, not civilians, that Hamas is using civilians as human shields. What do you make of their argument?
No, I mean, I think Israel acted in self-defense, and it has the right of self-defense. There's a bit of an irony in that the Gaza Strip is, under international law, actually an area occupied by Israel. It's not a foreign state. So there's a little bit of a problem here of just how do you call this self-defense if it's happening within an area that is under your occupation. But Israel has the right of self-defense. It's true that Hamas is, if it's not using people as human shields, it's embedded within the population. Of course, there's not much other room in Gaza to operate. But obviously, civilians are under threat, largely because Hamas is within densely populated areas. Whether the IDF is trying not to target civilians, that is not entirely clear at all, because the tactics of the IDF are indeed to call upon the population to leave populated areas because they will become areas of operation. But after a certain point, it begins treating those areas as if there are no civilians in them. So northern Gaza right now, which hypothetically has been emptied of its population, there's still an estimated 200,000 civilians. And the IDF is acting as if they don't exist there anymore because it told them to leave. Secondly, where are these people going? The Gaza Strip is quite small, and it has a population of about 2.3 million, 85% of whom are now displaced and are now congregating in a very small part of the strip, in the southwestern part of it. And so this has created a vast humanitarian problem. Meanwhile, the IDF, because of its own tactics, has flattened, as was said by some of these government officials and generals, has flattened much of northern Gaza. Well over half of the structures have been either destroyed or damaged. And so where is the population going to go back to? And there's also no commitment by the IDF or the Israeli government to allow those people back. There's no official commitment to do that. If they're not allowed back, and if what several government ministers have said, if they're encouraged to leave the Gaza Strip altogether, encouraged meaning by an accelerating humanitarian disaster that Israel has caused, then you could say there are greater merits to calling this ethnic cleansing verging on genocide.
Right, and proving genocide, it's a pretty high threshold to meet, is it not?
It is a very high threshold to meet, and the sort of problem here is that the ICJ does not deal with such questions as crimes against humanity or war crimes, which are easier to prove, although, of course, you also need a large amount of evidence for that. But I would say that my own view is that the filing by South Africa was a very positive move, whether genocide is proved or not, and I hope it's not. That is, I hope that there is no genocide happening or about to happen. But one reason why it might not happen is precisely what we are seeing now, that this is being debated. Just a couple of hours ago, the chief of staff of the Israeli army has instructed members of the legal team of the IDF to investigate all kinds of cases that have happened on the ground, so as to make sure that Israel is not in breach of international law, meaning they're listening very closely to what is happening. And that as such is already a positive move. It may act to hinder any kinds of policies that some people in the army and in Israeli politics are, you know, thinking about.
Speaking of politics, you mentioned the Genocide Convention, which was established in 1948 after the Holocaust, and of course the murder of 6 million Jews. State of Israel was established. There's an irony here as well. How do you see this playing out as Israel's role on the world stage as a democracy, regardless of the outcome?
Well, I think, first of all, there's an irony and a tragedy that the Genocide Convention, which was indeed came into force in large part because the atrocities of World War II and particularly the Holocaust, that now the State of Israel would be charged with that crime, or indicted at least in the ICJ. At first, I would say if there is evidence, or if there's suspicion, or if this is an act that might prevent it, then while it is ironic and tragic, it should be done, because the consequences of killing vast numbers of Palestinians are more tragic than that. In terms of Israeli politics, look, I mean, I think that Israeli politics has been veering to both more and more to the radical right and less toward any kind of accepted democracy. In the land between the Jordan and the sea, in historical mandatory Palestine, there are now 7 million Jews and 7 million Palestinians, and only the Jews have full democracy there. There are 2 million Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, but they're in many ways second-class citizens, and all the other Palestinians under Israeli control in Gaza and the West Bank do not enjoy democratic rights. So Israeli democracy has always had a problem, and the current government in the months leading to October 7th was trying to curb democracy also for the Jewish citizens of the state by its so-called judicial overhaul. It's kind of lucky that it failed in doing it, at least temporarily, because that would have made its position with the ICJ much more difficult, because the Israeli judicial system would have been seen as much more suspect than it is right now. But that is the direction of Israeli politics. Maybe this terrible tragedy that is unfolding right now will make people sit up and think we have to preserve democracy, and we have to make sure that all 14 million people in the territory controlled by Israel are living under a just system and have the same rights and dignity.
Omer Bartov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. Thank you so much.
It's 100 days already. You have to bring them back now.
Relatives of Israeli hostages being held by Hamas for nearly 100 days now stood by the Gaza fence Thursday, holding pictures of their loved ones and passing the microphone from one person to the next, taking turns shouting messages of love and support in hopes the captives would somehow hear them.
Omer, can you hear us? It's Ima and Abba. We're here. We're really close to you. We're fighting for you every single day. Al-Sham! טל שום, טלטלוני שלי, טלטלוני שלי, אנחנו עושים הכל להחזיר אותך הביתה. It's Etty and Brit. We came the whole way to Gaza. That you can hear us, that you will hear us. We love you.
Chaim Perry, your wife and family are here fighting for you every minute until you're back. Daddy, it's Noam. Mommy's okay.
Despite tireless campaigning by the families, a sense that time is passing while world attention shifts elsewhere has deepened their anguish as hopes have faded for a deal to secure the hostages' release. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Campaign events are being canceled in Iowa as wintry weather hampers both Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis as they press voters for support in the days before Monday's lead-off presidential caucuses. A record-breaking forecast for prolonged freezing temperatures, strong winds, and possibly life-threatening conditions on the night that Republican voters will gather to make their pick for the 2024 nominee. VOA's Kane Farabaugh is in Iowa, the first state in the nation to vote and to kick off the race for the White House.
Here in Iowa, it is the final 72 hours of the campaign before the Iowa caucus, and as you can see, the weather is really an issue here. This is some of the heaviest snow and certainly some of the coldest temperatures that have happened in Iowa around a caucus in many years. And so the question now is, how much is this going to impact turnout? Former President Donald Trump retains a commanding lead in polling. So really, the campaign here in the state for the candidates that are vying for that second place spot, which right now is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, the campaign events are geared to reach those people that they need to turn out to support them in the caucus meetings that will happen January 15th, Monday night. How much turnout is going to impact the ultimate vote result is still an open question here. And so those candidates that are trying to make a dent into that polling lead that former President Donald Trump has need to make sure that their supporters turn out to support them on the January 15th Iowa caucus. Reporting from Ankeny, Iowa, Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you very much for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.